fight with my pen. Late night, damn sunset, like in the sin.
Well, hello, hello, hello. God bless you, community family, and welcome to Gang Talk with Skip Toms and Sister Heron. You know, if you've been following us, and I say that every week, because we are in the business of waking our community, families, our neighbors, our youth, all of us, to help us end the gang violence that hurts us so much. So God bless you once again, and welcome to this very specific hour. And thank you, Skip, for being our co-host.
Thank you, Sister Heron, and as always, I give honor and praise to God. I'm truly grateful to be alive. Yeah. Was in on a phone conversation earlier, and the guy asked me how I was doing, and I said, I'm alive and well. I'm not dead or in jail, so I'm doing good. So
yes.
Truly grateful for the Lord letting me see this day and being able to be a co-host.
Well, you know, the joy in your story is that there is life after this death, and that's what I've called it. We joke about it, but our young men have been the walking dead in our community, not even knowing that they're so close to leaving us.
Right. You know, you just said something. Think about that little boy who was on the show with Bruce Willis, where he said, I see dead people.
Yes.
Right. Because what he said after that is he told Bruce Willis, he said, and some of them don't know they're dead.
They don't know they're dead.
So you're absolutely right. There's so many people who are spiritually dead, disconnected, just out there living today and not loving their life and not thriving, just barely surviving. So I agree wholeheartedly with what you just said.
Absolutely. And we're in the wake-up phase of this. So that's the good news for all of us. We are waking up. We are turning this corner. And whatever it takes to wake up, it's all right with me, as long as we don't sit and continue to be the apathy that allowed it to continue. So before we go on with our show, our custom is always to thank our guests from last week.
Yes. So since I've been sitting down, I've been thinking about who was our guest, and I'm truly grateful that my mind is right. And I want to say from the Tree of Life Baptist Church out of Watts, we had Pastor... I want to say Merchant.
Yes, Merchantson.
Merchantson, okay, yes. Pastor Merchantson, and also a big shout out to Mac. Yeah, to Mac Shorty.
Yes.
You know, for bringing him, and I wasn't here the week prior to that, but Mac Shorty's been doing his work, bringing people. So I truly appreciate the work he's been doing and making sure that Watts has a voice, not just in Watts, but international. You know, because we are international.
And even if we're not international, we need to be about our business right here in this community, and that's what I love about Mac. He brought a lot of respected community members out of the Watts neighborhood, and we had Dawu and Bow Wow and Rico and
Kiki.
Yes. Yeah. It was an excellent opportunity for us to get together and discuss some issues.
And Jackie, too, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Right. And I don't say her last name right, so if I don't say it right, I'm not going to say it. So, but we thank them all for coming. We really thank Mac for putting that together. And we had a chance to discuss Zach Randolph's unfortunate arrest.
Right.
At a Nickerson event. And so it was very important for the community to come and tell the truth of what happened rather than let the police department and the news misrepresent what started that. So I'm glad we had an opportunity for them to come and share that with the whole community instead of people just accepting the false representation.
Right.
And really what we need to, as we talk about that, talk about the damage to the goodwill that he was trying to bring to the community. You see, we get professionals like that to come to our community for whatever reason. They're coming to share some goodwill. Well, when the police disrupt that and arrest, doesn't that damage the desire for important men like him to continue to do that?
Right. You know, there's another story coming out of Las Vegas right now. A football player is outside Las Vegas, and someone comes up and I don't know what happens, but it was a lot of chaos, and they said it was a gun involved, so everybody took off running because they were frightened. And one of the famous football players, I'm gonna look at my phone and get his name in a minute, but he said he ran, and just because he was scared like everyone else, and he said one of the police officers knocked him down, and they actually filmed it. It's on the news where they put the gun to his head and said, if you move, I'll blow your head off. And he said there was a fear of life in him that he knew not to say anything, not to say, hey, look, man, I'm a million-dollar football player. I'm not out here playing with guns, you know.
Yeah.
He said, but just the fact that he was subjected to that, it lets him know that this is normal. This dysfunction is normal, not only to the police, but individuals who are normally getting guns pulled on them and subjected to that. So.
Yeah. Well, the threat to the black man, we just have to tell the truth. If you have any kind of gun on you, it could end your life.
Oh, without a doubt.
Without a doubt. And it's happened over and over again. That's been the excuse. And what do they say? Oh, I was afraid. He was running away from me, but he had that gun. So I was in fear for my life. So
his name is Michael Bennett.
Michael Bennett.
Michael Bennett, football player.
All right.
Yes.
Well, Michael, we're so sad that, sorry that that happened to you, and we're really upset. Oh, because as I read the update about Zach Randolph, supposedly he had 2 pounds. Supposedly he had 2 pounds of weed. That's what they arrested him for, and I'm just laughing. How much money did he expect to get out of 2 pounds of weed in Dickerson? Yeah. I mean, you know, it's such a joke. I mean, it's such a joke, and it's such a shame to have his effort at goodwill, bringing goodwill to the community, because it was a community event for one of his friends that had passed, and it was a birthday party. So we just really resent the fact that we don't have the kind of community relations with law enforcement that couldn't have been resolved in a better way.
Right.
So that's what we spent the last 2 weeks discussing. So tonight we have an extraordinary young man with us. Extraordinary.
Describe the extraordinary.
No, I'm going to let you describe the extraordinary, and he can too. So.
Okay. Well, he asked me not to describe the extraordinary. I know his journey and to where he is now. So he's a young man, you know, I don't want to say born and raised out here. I believe he came from New York, but he came out here at a young age, and now he's a professor at Cal State Long Beach, if I'm not mistaken, a graduate of the University of Second Call. Is that what
yes.
No, University of South Central.
South Central.
Right. So graduate of University of South Central. And
our favorite campus around here.
Yes, indeed, because it sits right in the community. Yes. So it's kind of hard for them to get around us, and it's hard for us to get around them. So you're a representation of both the community and the campus.
Yeah.
So my surprise guest, Alex Alonzo.
When I was about 12 years old, I used to go down Jefferson and see all the students crossing the street into USC. Mm-hmm. And I used to be fascinated and amazed by, you know, 50 kids are all going to this little campus. And I'm like, man, I wonder if I can go there one day.
It's not little anymore, is it?
It's, well, you know, when you're 12, your perception of the world is much different. And then I went there again when I was 13 to a football game. I got invited, and I was like, I asked the lady that took me to the game, how do you get into a school like this? And she said, you have to really get great grades. And then as I started to grow up, I forgot about that dream that I had when I was 12. Yeah. That dream was already deleted.
Yes.
But then I returned to that dream when I was about 22 years old. Mm-hmm. 22 years old, and I woke up one day and said, hey, this is about time I try to complete that task that I was thinking about back in the day. And actually, I applied when I was about 22, and I was denied.
Mm.
I was denied. They sent me a letter, and it said that, unfortunately, at this time, we're unable to accommodate you based on your Dorsey High School transcript.
Uh-oh.
I was ignorant of the process.
That was great.
I was completely ignorant of it. I didn't know a 1.9 GPA was going to be taken that seriously.
Oh, okay. Yeah, without a doubt.
I had no clue. So I had met a guy at Dorsey High School named Benny Blades, who became my mentor. And he schooled me on how to get into SC. He said, "You really want to get into SC?" I said, "I will do whatever it takes. Any class, any schedule, any shift, any job." And I did it. And that journey really started for me in 92, and I ended up graduating in 95. I did it in 3 years. And that's how determined. I give a lot of credit to meeting that guy, Benny Blades, at Dorsey High School one day, because his job was to try to find those motivated students, high school students, that wanted to, you know, really graduate, because it's hard. Most people don't care about.
Oh, I did. I went to Dorsey and I didn't care. I didn't know Benny Blades, and I think it's too late, Benny, for me. But
I think Benny was there a little after you was there.
Oh, okay.
And I was there after I had graduated. I had graduated from high school like 4 years before.
Oh, okay.
So I had just went up there to get my transcripts or to get some information, and that man was there, and it was a blessing to meet that man.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up being a counselor at Santa Monica College, and he set me up on the curriculum to transfer.
Right.
And then by the time I was done with SMC, he told me, "Man, you could transfer to any university in the country if you with these grades."
Right.
I said, "I'm gonna go to USC, man. I want to go right to where I had my eyes on from when I was 12 years old."
Well, that's a wonderful thing, brother. Wonderful.
Well, you know, and I hate to say, but whatever I dreamed at 12 for myself, this was not it. What I'm doing right now, no. And I want folks to understand that. This is all God's doing. You know, if you got weak faith, you ain't sure there is a God. Look at me and know that there is, because this was not a childhood ambition of mine. Never saw it coming.
12 years old, I want to be Lynn Swann.
Lynn Swann, okay.
Yeah, he was the wide receiver for the...
Number 88.
Well, first he was number 22 for USC.
Okay.
And then he became number 88 for the Steelers. And so I kind of had a similar dream. I said, "Man, I'm going to go to USC, be a wide receiver, then I'm play for Pittsburgh," and somewhere that all went out the window. I went to juvenile hall, then I went to jail and all that. And,
well, we were just talking about that, where we were doing at prom. And
right.
Where were you at prom, Skip? There was no prom, huh?
No, that was 81 for me. So in 81, I was being released from camp, I think. That's the year I got out. Yeah.
We joke about it, but you have, you know, due to circumstances, given a lot of your time to that process.
You know what? It's so funny. I don't want to take from the time we spend, but what's funny is that I spent a lot of time in jail. And that much time in prison, but the time I spent in jail, going, like I said, in camp, that was like a 7 month tour, right? I would go do 8 months, 20 days. I did what they call county lids. I did so many of them that I spent 6, maybe 7 years in jail,
right?
And just 2 years in prison, you know? So, that is dysfunction. But anyway, we're not talking about me and dysfunction. Alex Alonzo, man, you have somehow. Became successful growing up, living in Los Angeles. And what are some of your success stories? I don't want to say who you are and what you represent. Maybe you'll tell the people what your successes are.
I think my first success story is surviving the late 80s and early 90s without getting shot and killed, maimed.
Yes.
We lost a lot of people. In between 87 and 93, we lost a lot of people.
Yes.
Not just where I lived or where Skip lived, but you can bring anybody here from any neighborhood in LA, and they lost people between 87 and 93.
Yeah.
And when I look back at those years, I'm like, wow, I had close calls and a lot of violence in those years. I think to me, this is the most violent period in the history of the United States when you think about it, 87 to 93. So that's my first accomplishment, is how I navigated those years, you know, without getting killed.
Dead.
Yeah.
We call it getting dead. You didn't get dead.
Oh, yeah, getting dead. Or as we used to say back then, without getting our head peeled, our cat peeled.
Get your cat peeled.
I don't think they say that anymore, no.
Right.
No.
So then, going to college, I've always had I always wanted to go to college. I just never knew how to do it.
Mm.
And I didn't have parents that knew how to do it. My parents were actually immigrants. So you don't really get that good education on college. And, you know, on top of them being immigrants living in the neighborhood, I had to figure it out on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And figuring that out, that was kind of a tough little complicated, you know, web of all these steps you have to do, especially when you're trying to get into, you know, a prestigious university. Mm-hmm. You know, you can check into Cal State Northridge, and I apologize to my wife. I don't want to diss her.
Well, say Cal State Dominguez then.
Cal State Dominguez Hills. You know, there's many schools you can get into, four-year universities, and I appreciate and respect all of them because sometimes it doesn't really matter where you go to. But I had my mindset on going to SC. I really just, because I lived in the West Adams, Mid-City area, that was a school I used to see all the time, you know, millions of times, going up there in the pool, playing around. I witnessed the Olympics in 84.
Exposition Park.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I sold ice cream on Vermont in Exposition during the Olympics. Yeah.
You got an ice cream truck?
No, I had what was called like a freezer that you could wear over your shoulder.
Oh.
And it kept the ice cream cold in your little freezer you can walk around
with. You got a picture of that?
I don't. No. It was a hustle that I learned from this gentleman that I met on the east side, and you can go buy all these candies and ice creams warehouse price.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and so I just fell in love with the university from being around it for a kid, from being a kid. So that's, I guess, my second major accomplishment.
Well, you know what, and I'm so happy. I'm so happy that you had that opportunity, but it speaks to what you do now.
Right.
I want to know what brought you to that, from this dream you're just telling us that you began at 12, that you finally made happen to you later on. But look what you're doing now, not what before you became a professor at Cal State.
Yeah.
Well, I got. Who was the Alex Alonso that I met?
I got obsessed and fascinated with gang history.
Yes.
And really trying to learn about every gang member's individual journey, mm-hmm. how he or she got to where they're at whenever I meet them, whether they're former or current. And the more I did that, the more I just started to learn about history and how history had a big impact on the Crips and the Bloods. And the Crip and the Blood story, when I really got obsessed and just really dove into it in the mid-90s, I realized it doesn't start in the 90s, it doesn't start in the 80s, it doesn't start in the 70s. It really goes back, you could say, 50s and 40s, and you could really argue, you know, historically you can link other events that happened in L.A. all the way up until the formation of the Crips and Bloods, which happened in the 70s. So once I started linking all these events that went back to the 60s and then the 50s and the 40s, I really was like, wow, this is amazing. And then one of my professors at SC when I was an undergrad said, why don't you study this in grad school? Now, I didn't even have a plan to go to grad school. I said, grad school? I'm just trying to get this bachelor's degree and get up out of here. He said, no, I've been watching your grind from a distance. And it would be, you know, it would be a travesty not to continue your education. You don't have to stop with a bachelor's degree. So then I went through the journey of figuring out how to get into grad school with his help, Professor Kurt Roseman. And I did a master's thesis that was about the history of the Bloods and Crips. Hmm. And I would say it's a crude version. It's a crude history when I look back at it now, because I published it in 99.
Okay.
What I've learned since 99 is tremendous.
Yes,
you know, you know, I wish I could go back and redo it, but I guess my wheels got spinning with gang history,
mm-hmm.
and I really pretty much never left that to this day. In fact, before I was here, I had about an hour conversation with an OG West Side Crip at the post office. You know, mm-hmm. I went to the post office just to drop off an envelope and leave.
Oh.
I see one of the OGs, and I cannot just not talk to him.
No.
I want to talk to him for at least 5-10 minutes, and what does that turn into? An hour.
An hour.
That's what I told Cynthia Nunn this weekend. We were at a park, Gonzales Park, and Cynthia Nunn, whose family is very popular from the Compton area. Very known. And so Alex got to talking and talking, and I saw Cynthia, you know, trying to stand on one leg and another and turn like that. I said, he gonna keep talking as long as you sit here. So,
uh-huh.
But I mean, it was good for me too, because you brought up a name of a young man who was the first person killed in that Compton feud, Clifford Ray.
Clifford Ray.
Right. And Cynthia sat back and said, oh yeah, that was my boyfriend. So, you know, these are things that are really pertinent, and it's information that, you know, I like the fact that you pull it out of people, and I never would have known that, you know. So I think you got a lot of great information. And let me say this, too, that When I started with Ceasefire, there are some people who have come in who have said that I was the first, I was the original, I was this, I was that. But by me knowing you, by me knowing Bone, by me knowing King Baba Louie, he tells me they lying.
They're lying.
They're lying. And I know you and Bone do a lot of research and you guys find out the truth. And, you know, if it weren't for people like you and Bone, there'd be a lot of people out here writing their books and telling their stories mm-hmm. if they were the ones.
As if they were the
so
ones.
So I'm yeah. truly grateful that you have that passion to go back and get to the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes I don't like to say that someone was lying. I think that when you ask people about what was going on 40 years ago, just memories aren't that great.
Right.
And you ask five people about the same incident, you're getting five different stories. Now, is it that one person's telling the truth and the other four are lying? Or is it that they're seeing it from different perspectives and remembering it differently? Now, you're right. There are some people out here that are just blatantly lying.
So when you have five people and four of them seeing it different than the one, that's fine. Right. But when you have five people and all five of them say, I don't remember that person being there, that person wasn't a part of it, then that's just a flat-out lie.
It's a flat-out lie.
And I don't know if you remember the two people you had in your office that were in your office, and I thought one of them name was Thomas, but they were originals from the originals, and I brought up a name, and they said, man, he will not come into this office with us because we would say he's lying. You don't remember that?
I think I do remember. Thomas was the older guy.
Yes.
Little heavy set.
Yes.
He passed. He passed this year.
That was my guess that I wanted him to bring on. I didn't know he had passed. That
yeah. His name was T-Bone Ligone. That was his West when he was running with the West Sides in the 70s. T-Bone Ligone. His name is Thomas Ligone.
Thomas Ligone.
They called him T-Bone, T-Bone Ligone. In fact, I had called him up. I would call him once a month just to check up on him because he's always got an amazing story to tell.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted him to come on.
And when I'm usually thirsty for one of those old 70s stories, I call, you know, one of these guys up. And I called him up one day, and a woman answered the phone. No one ever answered this. A woman never answered this phone before. And she said, well, who are you? And I said, I've known Tom for, you know, almost 20 years. I met him in 96 or 97. She said, well, I'm sorry to let you know he passed. Had a heart attack in his apartment.
Wow.
So, unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. Mm-hmm. Thomas Ligone, rest in peace.
Yeah. Well, he ain't going to be on the show, sister.
No, I guess not.
Had a surprise guest for you, and I just got my surprise.
It's all right. You know, our life is full of surprises based on the weekend and the phone calls. You know, that's what it's been for me. And I actually had a schedule, you know, that I would just get prepared from Thursday to Sunday and wait for the results on Monday when those statistics would come in. Wow. So it started from Thursday and went all the way through the weekend waiting to hear what happened by Monday. Right. So, you know, we don't know why. We're just here trying to find a way to fix what's been broken in us. And I say it very candidly because as a child at 12, you didn't say, I'm going to go to SC and be an expert in gang violence, right. in gang history. You didn't tell yourself that as a child, but at some point in your life, as in mine, there was a turning point. Skip's is based on coming back and finding his right mind, okay? You and I took a different approach, and that's to get involved in it. So I want to know what that momentum was for you that now you went from your dream to be an SC student, to graduate from SC, then now you did your master paper on the history of, where did that come from?
Well, I didn't know that grad school was as customized as you want it to be. When I was told that you could write your master's thesis on anything you want to write it on, and I said, can I write it on gangs? They said, absolutely. Then I was like, I'm with it. Because that's the topic that is most near and dear to me than any other topic.
Very knowledgeable. You're expert.
So, well,
you're expert. No, come on.
I like to look, historian.
Let's just verify that when they want an expert to come and be in that witness stand and testify of how this thing operates, they will call you.
Yeah. When in the court, jargon, they use that word expert, but I like historian more so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was looking through some old papers that I wrote when I was in junior high school, and a lot of my papers were geared toward this topic. I found a paper that I wrote about the Bataram.
Oh.
In 1985.
You can't stop it, baby.
Yeah, I wrote a report. The teacher told us in,
I remember that
in the ninth grade, write a report on anything you want to write it on. So I wrote a report on the Bataram. You know,
oh
so I
God.
Always had interests in these topics that, you know, that plague our community. It's just crazy that as not even a teenager, well, yeah, I was like 13 or 14, writing papers about the police, you know.
Right.
I didn't know I was going to write.
Well, that was abuse, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't realize it was abuse when I wrote that paper in the ninth grade. I actually wrote something along the lines that, you know, the chief has to figure out a way to get the drugs out of the people's hands. When I look at that paper, I'm like, this is not even me. I don't even think like this.
Right.
But, you know, that was, you know, 1985 right. or 84. Yeah. So I've always been interested in these topics going back to even before middle school, because actually my dad and my uncle grew up in the streets.
Mm.
My uncle actually founded a gang called the Puerto Rican Tigers in the Bronx in New York when I was a kid. So as a kid, you know, I've had all of these kind of gang figures around me all the time. And then when I moved to L.A., and started going to, I came here in the sixth grade and seventh grade, and I started meeting Crips and Bloods. I was like, oh, this is cool. They got gangs out here, too.
Oh.
It's a different kind of thing.
Different kind.
But,
yeah.
You know, I'm sure I'm going to vibe with some of these people at some point in time.
You said vibe.
Vibe, yeah, Lord.
Because I've always gravitated towards them. Yeah. When I was at John Burroughs Middle School, just about 90% of the friends I had when I was in the seventh grade, which would have put me at 12, 13 years old, were all gang members. Mm. I was like, oh, they're the gang members. Those are the guys that I could identify with. I know how your parents are. I know what your get down's like. You know, if I've experienced it where I lived, you guys are cool to me. So I kind of embraced all of them at an early age when I got to L.A.
How did they receive you?
You know what? When I first got to L.A., they thought I was like, they knew I was an outsider because I spoke more with an accent. The first year here, I was like, where are you from? You
know? Yeah, they knew.
So it was like, oh, this guy's not one of us. He's an outsider. But eventually, you know, I did 3 years at that school from seventh to ninth grade, and everyone eventually, you know, loved me by the time I left that school. And what's funny is, you know, I'm heavily into videotaping and documentaries. I had a small little camera in the seventh grade, a little 110. Popped that 110 film in there, and I was taking pictures of the gang members at John Burroughs when I was in the seventh and eighth grade. I was looking at some old pictures. So I've always been doing something that's kind of related to, you know, what I'm doing now. I didn't know what I was going to be doing, you know, 20 years from that point, but I've always been somewhat, you know, dabbling in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, documenting it, yeah. Taking a picture. I used to see the Mansfield Crips a lot at my school, and I used to say, hey, get up against the wall, I want to take a picture. Y'all like, for what? I'm like, I just want to take a picture.
Get
just
up against the wall.
Right. All right.
You know,
hey, I gotta go through some of those pictures, see if you got Looney on one of them, man. Looney or Bonnerice.
I got Looney in my yearbook for sure, but I don't have Looney in any of my personal
pictures.
Nah.
Okay.
But yeah, I knew Looney well. I think I did 3 years in school. I'm talking like I did prison time.
Right, you can say you did 3 years.
You didn't do 3 years, bro.
I'm just
up against the wall. Right.
I attended John Burroughs Junior High
for
3 years, and I think Looney was there for the same 3 years I was there. He may have been 1 year older. He may have attended 2 years while I attended. But yeah, I got to know Looney, you know, pretty well during them years.
Right.
You know, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but John Burroughs seems so far removed from the schools of really under threat. I mean, really. And I came out with one of them, John Muir, the junior high school.
Oh, yeah. People get dead at John Muir.
Yes.
They
oh
just shot them baby at the donut stand last year. Remember that?
Yes.
Well, here's the thing. John Burroughs was the next closest school to Mount Vernon.
Yeah.
Mount Vernon, I could have either went to Mount Vernon or John Burroughs.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up going to John Burroughs. And then Fairfax is the next school.
Mm-hmm.
And now if you want to talk about being far removed,
yeah,
Fairfax is way far removed. But check this out.
Because look, you just gave the pattern.
Right.
Vermont, junior high school.
Mount Vernon.
Mount Vernon, thank you, because now it's Johnny Cochran.
Yeah, Johnny Cochran.
Okay, so I forgot about Mount Vernon because that's the place where George Washington held the slaves. So to rename that school, I ain't mad. Johnny Cochran, I ain't mad. So anyway, but to say, here you got Mount Vernon. They right in the mix, so close to Crenshaw. I mean, they could see it from the campus. And then you go over to John Burroughs, which is a little more west, and Fairfax, which is really out of the zone.
Well, guess which school is the first school in the LAUSD to have two on-campus homicides?
I'm going to tell you, it was Fairfax. I know the
Fairfax.
Little boy, and I'm going to tell you when it was.
Two on-campus homicides.
It was 1987 for that one little boy. Was it 87? Because I was in the PN.
Yeah, both of them were in the 80s. Oh, no, I think one was 86. Late 80s, one was early 90s, maybe.
Okay.
Antoine, right. Can't remember his last name. He was a victim.
Right.
And I can't remember the other one. But
I'm going to tell you when it was. It was either 86 or 87 because I was in prison when it happened.
Okay.
So for a school that's far removed from the hood, thing is, these are the schools that everyone that went to John Burroughs Junior High were from. Either the Mid-City or West Adams or even further. They
John
would come
Burroughs
there.
Was an opportunity campus. That's really what it was because I had, we thought, we had high regard for John Burroughs in the day and because I went to Mount Vernon. I'm not ashamed of it.
You didn't want to send your kids to Mount Vernon, yeah.
It wasn't that I didn't want to send my kids. By the time I had kids, my only thing was I wanted them to be in a safe school where they would get an education. That really was my priority. First, it had to be safe. Then the second part, it had to be a quality education. But we were in the John Muir district, and Manuel was a feeder school.
Right.
And at those years, it's like that was my biggest fear.
Oh, no. Don't send your kids to Manuel, man.
No.
Not in the 80s either, man.
I couldn't do it.
So in the 80s, the dark side of what they call the Rolling 40s, that was a fight between the four Trey Hoovers and what eventually became the Rolling 40 Crips. I think it was some East Coast down there at the time. So, yeah, definitely I wouldn't. If I know now. What I know now, if I could have been able to share with parents back then, there'd be a lot of children alive. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would be alive if they had historians and people to say, look, now is not the time. Please don't send your children here.
Yeah. You know, and one of the things that really hurt me, when I went to withdraw my kids from John Muir, the principal begged me to give this school a chance. He said, you know, Ms. Heron, we're really trying to make a difference here in this campus. And I believed him, but I wasn't willing to take the risk.
Mm-hmm.
I just wasn't willing to take the risk.
I can gamble with some money or my car or something, my skateboard or my skates, man, but I can't gamble with my children.
But then the other side of it, they went from there to Audubon and Crenshaw. So they're going to school every day in their enemy's territory.
Right.
So, you know, it was a learning time for me because I didn't really start until 88, and that was when Charlotte Austin Jordan's daughter was killed,
right.
Jamie Finney. And that's when it got personal for me because she and my child were classmates. That was her friend.
Right.
You see, I was one of those, as long as it ain't over here, I'm good.
Right.
I was living like that.
Let me say real quick that my mother sent me to Catholic school.
Yes.
So I went to St. Bridget's, which is on 52nd and Western.
Yes.
And then we went to St. Anselm's, which is now a Kipp school on Van Ness and 70th Street. So let me tell you what I learned at both of these schools. I learned about the Crips. Because they were coming to victimize us.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned to fight walking down Western. And when I got to the school, St. Anselm's, this is where I met the Springers. And if you know anything about the 60s, it's Larry, John L. Springer, Cat Springer, who used to be with Bo. It's a whole family of Springers, and all of them could fight. JD.
Like nuns.
Right. They like the nuns, but they own Arlington. So even though my mother wanted to protect me and keep me away from it, she put me right in the heart of it.
Not knowing.
So then she had the idea to move on 66 and Dinker. All right.
Mm-hmm.
She thought, okay, moving off of 20th and Central. We lived on 20th and Griffin. If we move on 66th and Dinker, this is the west side. It's a better neighborhood. Well, let me tell you who hangs out on 67th and Dinker, but who lives on 69th and Dinker. Do you know who lives on 69th and Dinker?
Master Cody,
his brother Deshaun, Michael and Todd Orso at the corner.
The North Side A-Trays.
The North Side A-Trays.
You know,
right.
And
so my mother tried to do her best.
Well, you know what? See, because we didn't know. We really didn't know. And even in my most recent history, we had a mother bring her son to our church because he was all hooded up and thugged up and shut down, living at 17 years old, his life for his friends and the corner that he was so fond of. And so she brought him to our church to try to soften him up and everything, a little bit get to him. I understood her motives. And we did our best with that young man. And she thought, the best thing I can do now is move him out the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So she did, but she relocated him in somebody else's gang territory, right. not knowing. So what did he do? He abandoned that, came back over to his neighborhood that he was familiar with, and that's where he died.
Right.
That's where he died, you see. But she was trying to do the right thing to save both her boys,
right.
But not knowing, you done took him from the frying pan and put him right in the fire.
Right.
And he knew it. It's like, I can't stay over here, Mom. I just can't do it, you see. And so not being able to verbalize that to her where she would understand, he just abandoned the whole thing and came back over to
exactly.
What was familiar.
And that's normally what the 13, 14-year-old does, you know, no matter where my mother moved.
He died at 17.
Yeah.
He was killed at 17.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, listen, man, Alex, there's so much more that you are doing now, and we haven't even gotten into it. Internet. You have mastered the internet. There was something that you shared with me about people. You have a machine or some kind of way of finding out when there are people starting stuff on the internet saying like, hey, I'm from this neighborhood and I'm going to kill you and your kids or whatever, that you can actually go and find out, well, Skip, this guy is in Australia.
Oh,
this
yeah.
guy is in Oklahoma. This guy isn't even out here, but he's saying that there's a fight on Crenshaw, and he's saying, yeah, I'm going to come later on and kill your family because y'all shot at me today or whatever. Alex can actually go online and see that he's not even in L.A. He's not even a part. What you call him, a troll?
Remember we talked about trolls? I think you hadn't heard of it, but I'm sure you've heard this
I've
word
heard it now.
Many,
yeah,
many times now.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things you do. I don't want to cut it, brother. Start there. Or
well, I don't really take too much. I know the internet is a place where something negative can start.
Yes.
And we're always kind of concerned about it. But I don't take it as seriously as everyone else does, because I know that people are just looking to, you know, just let off some steam, as they say. So even today, I was looking at a bunch of comments. A lot of them are geared towards me, and I just laugh at them. You know, I just laugh at him. There's one guy that's trolling all over YouTube that has a picture of me in his profile, and he just says all kind of crazy things. Mm. But yeah, that's just by using the IP address. I think now anyone that goes on the computer as much as I do knows how to take an IP address and figure out what city or what state or what country they're in by going to different websites and punching that IP address in. With YouTube, it's a little harder. Gmail actually strips their IP address. It's hard to track Gmail accounts. But, you know, there's ways to find out where someone's at based on that particular post. So, yeah, I kind of got good at that. But it started at SC. I never used a computer in my life until I got to college. You know? And I didn't have an email until I got to college. Actually, email was kind of new, so it makes sense that most of us didn't have emails in the early 90s. Even though it did come out in the late 80s. So I got fascinated with computers. And then when I got real good at it, I tried to teach as many of the homies that I
how
knew
to use it,
a little something like, hey, this is going to be the future. Hey, you got your email. You better get your email. And, you know, just, you know, don't fall behind, because this is going to take over, you know.
Yeah.
And as you can see, look how much of a role this internet technology
it's
plays in our lives.
Cyberspace. It's all cyberspace.
I knew this was going to happen in the 90s. I bought StreetGangs.com in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? 1998. Because I knew that this was where it was going.
Yeah.
So that was 19 years ago.
Right.
That's 19 years ago I bought that domain name.
Yes.
If I had more money at the time, I would have bought more domain names. But they were charging $75 a domain name back then. Now you can get them on GoDaddy for like $10. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that's really what.
And I tried to get my name, SkipTownsend.com, yeah, and they wanted $1,900.
You know what it is? It's because someone else owns it, and they want to sell it to you.
They want
to
sell you.
But
your
why
own
would they
name.
Pick my name, though?
To sell it to you.
Yeah, to sell it. Didn't you ever hear? Tavis Smiley told that whole story that he wanted to buy his name. Someone else bought it and
already
said, oh, you got to buy it from me.
You got to buy it from me.
So his website is Tavis Talks. He couldn't get Tavis Smiley. He said, I'm not going to buy that.
No. Right. Yeah. And isn't that a mess? They can buy your name, and then you have to buy it from them. It's, how do you get to buy what's mine?
I bought my name maybe 10 years ago. I bought alexalonzo.com, alexalonzo.net, alexalonzo. I bought them all.
All.
Yeah. I'm not doing anything with all of them, but I wanted to own those domain names. Yes. That's my name.
Yes.
So I got into that. But in terms of some of the gang history, you know, I've really been, all this year, I've really been trying to uncover the history of this gang called the Avenues. The Avenues predate the Crips. They predate the Bloods. But they have a large impact on the culture today. In fact, the leader of the Avenues, because of him, we have the Crips.
Mm. Right.
Because of him. His name's Craig Munson.
Craig Munson. That's now, who I thought. So when I asked you for, what's his name? Just passed away.
Thomas Lagone?
Thomas. So Craig Munson had a brother named Thomas, didn't he?
No. Craig Munson has a brother. No, he doesn't have a brother named Thomas. He has a lot of brothers, though, but none of them are named Thomas.
Okay, so that's who I thought that was in your office. I thought that was Craig Munson's brother.
No, they're not brothers. Okay. But Craig Munson's story is really fascinating because he started a gang in 65, 66 called the Avenues. And at that time, Craig Munson was probably had the biggest reputation in the streets. His run was from the 65, and then he ended up going to prison for murder in 1970. And he did 5 years on a 1-15 sentence. Wow. For involuntary manslaughter, which is a sentence you would never get today.
Right. No.
You'll never get that sentence today.
It would start off with either 15 to life or 70. Yeah. I mean, 15 or 25, right?
And at that time, 17. When you got 1 to 15 in the 70s, you actually had a parole. You went to parole after 1 year, even though you just killed somebody. Can you believe that?
Right.
So he went to parole. But they knew back then that you had to at least go to your third parole, I think. And by that time, you did about 4.5, 5 years. So eventually he got out. And by this time, there are no Avenues. That gang is defunct. Mm-hmm. He comes out to a whole new tapestry of gangs, Crips, Bloods, which was something that would not have existed if he allowed Raymond Washington, who we all know as the founder of the Crips, join his gang. Raymond wanted to be in Avenues.
Oh.
That was his number one thing. He was looking up to Craig Munson. I want to be just like Craig Munson. Mm. But Craig said, you're not going to be part of our thing. So eventually Raymond goes on and says, all right, if you're not going to let me be part of your thing, I'm going to create my own thing. And that's really how it went. In fact, there's an interesting story where Craig actually revolutionized bodybuilding, weightlifting, Craig Munson. Bodybuilding was not a big thing for black folks in the 50s and 60s. Mm. Very few people were lifting weights. In fact, they were always telling people, why are you lifting weights? That's bad for you. So they loved it. And he was probably one of the biggest bodybuilders in the history of bodybuilding. And I'm not exaggerating. Arnold told Craig Munson once, don't flex on me when they're going to take a picture. Because he's bigger than Arnold.
Yeah.
Fletcher did an interview not too long ago saying the biggest dude I ever saw wasn't even a professional bodybuilder. It was Craig Munson. So a lot of people who saw Craig Munson in his height will say, this is the biggest brother that has ever walked the planet.
So way bigger than Stanley Tookie Williams.
Oh, yeah. Stanley used to work out with Craig Munson in the late 70s. In fact, they worked out together at a gym called Bill Pearl's Gym on Manchester in A-Tray Hood. The gym is still there. It's just got a different name. And Tookie would call Craig Munson's mom up and say, hey, I need to know where Craig's going to be. I want to work out with him. Because Tookie wanted to be big like Craig. Mm-hmm. Tookie did not have the vascularity, the veins that would pop out, and the size that Craig had.
He's still big brother, though.
And he did become big. Imagine that. As big as Tookie was, he was nowhere the size of Craig Munson.
Wow.
And there's this funny story. Craig is about to be released from San Quentin Prison. And they ask him, how big are your arms? And he says they're 22. and it's a parole hearing. They said, all right, come back when they're 23. No. You know, so he had to wait, and he actually got his arms bigger. So he told me he walked into prison with 21-inch arms and probably left with 22.5, 23s. That's considered huge.
Yes.
Even with the biggest professional bodybuilders, that's huge. But unfortunately, he never went pro. He competed on the amateur ranks. But there's a lot of politics in bodybuilding, especially when you're a black dude doing the bodybuilding thing. And he didn't come through the ranks as most bodybuilders. You know, you come as a teenager, you compete as a teen, then you
become. That way they can see your process.
Yeah.
And they could actually document it and show it.
Right? They didn't like the fact that he came from prison.
Yeah.
And he was from San Quentin. So unfortunately, he didn't get to do that.
And the creator of the avenues. Come on, look.
I don't know if they held that against him. But his story
I'm making a broad joke here.
Yeah.
But the truth is, this is gang talk. I'm glad he was a bodybuilder, but more important to me, he developed avenues, and that Raymond Washington wanted to be an avenues, and because he couldn't be an avenues, he came back and created the Crips, and now here we are.
But gang here culture we are. Influenced bodybuilding. These guys they had the techniques.
I don't have any doubt about that. You know, it seems like the brother took his prison sentence and decided, well, this is where I'm going to go get buff.
No, here's the thing. He walked into prison buff.
Okay.
He was buff.
Yes,
he was buff. Probably when he was 16, 17, was already buffed.
Yeah.
He walked into San Quentin with 21s. Who is this dude? So I think that in terms of the gang culture's influence so much. We think about rap. We think about music. We think about cults, clothing, and bodybuilding. Believe it or not, these gang members in the late 60s, early 70s had a huge impact. One of the first black bodybuilders was the dude named Mike Christian. You know about Mike Christian? He was the leader of the Inglewood Crips in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. Inglewood Crips. Mike Christian. So there's a lot of things outside of just rap and culture, fashion, that gang culture has a large impact on. And that's what I'm trying to uncover in this story. It's like, wow, this impact on bodybuilding. All these dudes. And now when dudes were going to prison in the 80s and 90s, what were they doing?
Lifting weights. Before they took the weights off the yard.
Yeah, before they took them off the yard.
Let me ask you a question real quick, because this is one of the issues I have when you say gang members. So thinking about, let's be honest too, in the African-American community, you just said the Inglewood Crips, which I would say now has to be the Imperial Village or the Raymonds or the Legends or something, because there are no more Crips in Inglewood other than those three. But would you actually call them gang members? So just think about the people that you know, and then let's think about the different culture. Let's think about the Inglewood Thresays or the 18th Streets or the MS-13. When you talk about the black community, I do not believe there is a such thing as a gang member. Because there is no hierarchy. There is no matter of fact, let me just speak for myself. I'd like to retire. I'm 53. I would like to retire from the blood gangs. Who do I go to? You're the expert. Where do I go get my 401k? Where do I get my retirement plan for? Where do I get my money? Because I put in. I've been to jail. I've been to prison. I ain't told on nobody. So I'm entitled. Yeah. That doesn't work. But in this other culture, there are rules, regulations, and consequences for actions.
Right.
So I would be able to say, and there's somewhere else to go, whether it's El Salvador, whether it's Mexico, whether it's Guatemala. But in this culture, if I did something wrong, first of all, the people with me probably going to tell on me. Yeah. I don't have another culture to go to. I can't go to another country. No. I'd have to go to Texas, which is underwater. I had to go to my family, Louisiana or Texas.
You can't even go to another neighborhood.
I can't even go right now because I'd have to swim. So do you still consider those individuals gang members, or what would be another term?
Man, that question is a very difficult question to answer. It's basically like, what labels do we ascribe to these groups to where we're all satisfied by using these labels? Now, I took the word gang and I researched where this word came from going back 100 years. And when you look at the literature in the early 1900s, we're talking about 1905, 1910, when they talked about a gang of youth, it was like kids that were going to go fishing, or maybe they were playing dice. Once in a while, they'll get involved in a little bit of nefarious activity, maybe a fight, but the word gang did not have the stigma. Mm-hmm. In the early 1900s, and really the first part of the 20th century, it didn't have the stigma until when? Blacks and browns
started to get called gang. Now I want to be able to say gang, just like the way they used to say it in the 19-teens and the 1920s, without the stigma. So I think why can't we just erase the stigma from the word gang, rather than just changing the whole terminology?
Because there's a gang enhancement, a gang instruction.
Yeah,
there's about 12 years associated with gang.
Whatever you want to call it. They're going to eventually put an injunction on that and put a RICO on that. I just think that we need to remove the stigma, because why can white people say these were gangs from 1900 to 1950 without the stigma? But then when the 60s and 70s come, now these gangs are considered, you know, diabolical, evil, and they put all of that stigma.
The media doesn't say, like in law enforcement or even in court, they say presumed, or I forgot what they say, alleged. Comes before everything.
Yeah.
But the media says a documented gang member shot at the police officers today.
Yeah.
They don't say an alleged gang member.
No.
They say a documented gang member is on trial.
Well, let's define documented gang. Documented gang member doesn't really mean gang member. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Documented gang member just means that
law
a police
enforcement
officer,
documented
one police officer said, "What's your name?" And he put on there, "I think he's a gang member. Maybe he's a gang member.
Mm-hmm.
He probably is a gang member." That's what documented means. So right. Being a documented gang member
does not mean
you're a gang member.
Well, you know what? We talked about last week, week before last, how the LAPD members of the crash would just see you on the street corner and throw that injunction throw it at you. You're in the gang injunction now.
Right.
You know, just take your picture, throw that paper at you, and put you in the injunction. So, you know, we've had a lot of hurdles thrown at us, built because of this, that we're just really trying to survive and drag our kids along out of the nightmare. So we really don't have the ability to explain everything, explain everybody, but you're a phenomena that came up with a very specific purpose, and that is to study this. To study the whole phenomena of it, because for me, it is a phenomena. You know, to come from the civil rights struggle, to see the strength of the Panthers, to see Malcolm's conviction about who black men really are in this country, to see Dr. King make the sacrifice trying to do it the nice way when I was on the Malcolm side. Let's go punch him in the throat like Skip says all the time. I just want to get at it, you know. And so we've been through a lot of stuff. And then to see how it turned on us, how we turned on ourselves, that's the biggest phenomena that we really need to respect, considering all the things that we've been through as a people in this country, that how did that happen? How do we turn against ourselves?
Right.
What's that about? And why are we so silent about it? Right. Why don't we care about this more? You know, see, so by you being the expert, we get to show you off and tell our apathetic. See, this man who had a dream at 12 years old just to go to a fine university has now found a way to come back and be a substantial member of our community, doing something that's meaningful. That's meaningful. You're changing lives, you see, right. Where most of us are just trying to migrate through the day.
Right. And before we get off the air, sister, I have to say that earlier this year, one of my community members died of a heart attack, and we're all out hanging out, and you know, it's a bunch of guys, older guys. I consider myself a little overweight. That's what the doctor told me, right? So it's a bunch of older, overweight guys. And Alex Alonzo is out there as well. And law enforcement came with heavy enforcement.
Yeah.
And they came and said, "Hey, you guys get against the wall. You guys do this."
Get against
and I'm sitting there looking like, you know, I told him, I said, "Hey, don't worry, officer. I got him. It's just one guy right here. I got him." And I'm thinking that they on my friend Mikey, because he's belligerent, you know. I said, "No, don't worry, officer. We're going to get him." And they said, "Okay, but all of you get against the wall." I said, "All of us?"
All of
us. And I'm thinking, man, we're this is the 50 club, man. If they're not 50, they're going to be 50 in the next 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a 50-year-old, and you were one of them.
It's humiliating, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Speak to that, man.
It's so disrespectful.
Speak to that and how that they labeled us based on the fact that it was the gang unit, and they had no idea they had a Skip Townsend and an Alex Alonzo out there.
Mm-mm.
Right.
I just feel humiliated when I go through those types of experiences with law enforcement. And I feel like we should never accommodate the police if we don't have to. Mm-hmm. For example, you don't have to show them your ID.
Mm-hmm. Right. I remember
you only said unless
that.
You're driving. Mm-hmm. Unless you're driving, that's the only time you have to show your ID. And I didn't want to show my ID, but they grabbed it out of my back pocket anyway. Yeah. So,
well, you know what's so sad about it? We have rights until they start telling you what they want you to do.
Maybe we really don't have rights. That's
the joke.
Because our law enforcement here in L.A. has become a military force. Yes,
an occupying military force.
Especially Metro.
Yes.
And you're going to lose against them almost 99.9% of the time, you know.
Well, let me say this. We had a very good weekend. I live across the street from a park. There's blood in the grass of that park like it is in most of our parks, okay? People have died there. Well, we've come a long way. So there was a very peaceful weekend until the sun went down. And what actually happened, these two Hispanic women had a girl fight in the park. Okay? And one of them threw her baby down. The other one let the vending cart fall on her baby. That's what brought the black women in. Oh, no, you ain't going to do this. You're hurting the kids. And so they followed the perpetrator down the street trying to get her arrested. Well, now the bird is flying over, lights on, all that stuff. So I come out because now the ladies are standing in front of my house. I want to find out what's going on. They tell me about the girl fight. We're waiting for the police. They call the police. When the SUV rolled up and homeboy jumped out the back, they were trying, hey, look, blah, 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 blah. It's like, wait a minute. That's a wrong approach from the very beginning. Right. So that sent up the red flares in my head. I didn't like the way he approached us. These women are witnesses. And you come out like they're the criminal. You coming out gangbusters. I pulled my cell phone out and took a picture. Mm-hmm. I took a picture of that officer just in case. Right. And I think that's the best advice.
Or film.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have to film, but just taking that picture and him seeing me take that picture. When they came back to talk to us, the tone had changed.
Right.
You see, because I live in the area where that officer you want me to meet.
Right.
Arrested those murderers instead of shooting the three of them in the back.
Right.
You see, whereas in Nickerson 2 weeks ago, they shot a man for running away in broad daylight.
Right.
See, and we still don't have an answer. We still don't have an answer. So what I've been pushing for, and I'm still thinking about this community-led review board, maybe initiated by Ceasefire and Watts Gang Task Force partnering to have that review, that community review thing, so we can build these cases.
Right.
Yeah. Talk to our witnesses, this kind of thing.
Yes, indeed. Sister, we're going to run out of time. It's been an hour. Don't seem like it. Don't seem like an hour, but it's been an hour. So I got to ask you, Alex, man, if you want to. Yeah, it was quick. There are a lot of people who are looking up to you. Mm-hmm. Just like the guy has your picture on the internet or whatever, there are a lot of people who you know, I mean, I seen it at the park, you know, when we were walking around, and, hey, that's him. That's Alex, him. Right?
Yeah.
So what do you say to individuals who have a dream or want to share, want to live in your dream? Is there anything that you can leave our community family with?
Well, I like to influence a lot of the young guys that come up to me to get into some sort of artistic endeavor outside of rap, you know.
Yeah.
I like to put a camera in a guy's hand a computer or editing. So people always ask me, like, how do you do this, you know? And I say, I started with a camera in my hand that my mom gave me when I was a kid, and I just stayed with it. That was my art, you know. And I feel that the arts, a lot of the kids now in school don't get the arts in middle school and high school like we used to get with musical instruments and different things. They've gotten rid of the arts in most of middle schools and high schools. And I think the arts, you figure you go to middle school and high school for 6 years. If you're doing arts and some sort of arts every year, how much influence is that having on your brain artistically that they just wiped away? You know? So I have to try to implant a seed of art into some of the guys that I meet. And it's hard, man. It's really difficult because they look at a camera and like, oh, I don't know how to work that. I'm like, you can learn.
And then what am I going to do with it? You know, one of the things that this nightmare has done is robbed our children of their imagination.
Absolutely.
Imagination and their desire to dream and have that dream come full term like you did.
Right.
You know, see, and that's one of my biggest regrets is how do we give that back to them?
Right.
You know, they've been exposed to so much negativity. How do we give that?
We can do it as parents, but, you know, when our kids go to school for, what, 6 hours a day,
yeah.
you wish that they're getting all this other, you know,
yeah.
Influence and artistic ideas and motivation, but they're not. You
no,
know, it's
right.
you can't just sit in front of a board looking at numbers and learning his story all day long and then expect them to be successful
right.
when you strip the arts. So, you know, I'm a big fan of the arts. I do arts almost every day, whether it's camera work or drawing. And I have art books for all my kids. I say one of the rules, and they don't always do it, is you have to draw something every day.
Mm.
Draw one thing every day in this book because it really gets the brain going and
right.
it really can create inspiration and get them on a path that they would not have been on.
Right. I appreciate it, brother. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
I'm an artist myself, man. I'm an Earth, Wind, and Fire artist, man. I play music. I used to have the album, and I would just put the album down and play Keep Your Head to the Sky by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
We got too many rappers out here, though.
Right.
Yeah, we do.
Got to get
too
more
many
musicians.
Rappers. There's God other things you. You guys can do, man, other than rap.
Something else. Yeah, you got to learn more words. God bless you, community family.
Thank you
for listening, and Gang Talk will be back next week.